Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello again, my wonderful, wonderful audience. As always, it's just amazing that I get to talk to you each week. And almost as amazing that I get to have wonderful guests to talk to, get to know, to enjoy. I make a lot of friends by doing this show. And that is on the part of the guests that come to listen to me. Maybe some of the listeners are not always as in sync with me as my guests are. And today it's Lieutenant Frank Moore. Frank is a retired lieutenant with the police department of New York City.
FDNY.
And he is, we didn't mention it earlier, but he is retired now in part because he was at 9/11 and spent enough time there to develop some of those respiratory issues. So he's a hero. He's a first responder. He's a hero. He's a wonderful man. His book is really good. I don't hold up books too often on this radio show, TV show. But here's Frank's book. It's America the Exceptional, Restoring a Wayward Nation's Greatness. America the Exceptional. Can people get this on Amazon?
Absolutely.
Well, that is terrific. And I like this book. It reminds me a little bit of my own book, While I'm an American. But I'm just going to focus beyond that on Frank's book. And it was written and published before the current COVID-19 crisis. And what's so interesting, and Frank was helpful to me in this way, he really finds the decline of American courage, independence, American belief in liberty, most of all, to the attacks on the Twin Towers and our response to it. Thinking about it in retrospect, how the media hid the towers, you know, didn't want to show the towers, didn't want to get us riled up. We see the beginning, I think, of the global predators, as I call them, coming to the fray to suppress American outrage, American independence, American determination to fight for its liberty. And instead, we begin a process of gradually caving in. Does that make sense to you, Frank?
I think that's exactly spot on.
Well, good. Now, I want to mention Ginger in my book, and it dovetails beautifully with this. And it's COVID-19 and the global predators. And we have now put the book on advance sale. And at a really cut-rate price. It's not up on Amazon yet because we don't have a book to put up on Amazon yet. It hasn't been gone to the distributor. But I didn't want to wait to go up on Amazon. Ginger didn't want to wait because we feel this information is so valuable, you should get it before the book is even available. So I came up with a unique solution. If you go and buy the advanced copy of this book, which you'll get in a month or so, and it's not fixed in stone, you will instantly get the manuscript. And I don't know anybody that's done this. And the manuscript has some flaws in it. You know, it takes risks to do this. It hasn't come back from the copy editor yet, the final copy editor. But I just didn't want to wait. So if you go and get the book, you can get it. We have a dedicated website, And the dedicated website is We Are the Prey. It's the subtitle of the book. We thought you'd remember that better than even COVID-19 and the global predators. WeAreThePrey.com. And you can spell prey wrong, and it'll probably still get there because that was Ginger's genius, was to also buy We Are the Prey, P-R-A-Y, instead of the correct P-R-E-Y. And you will get the book at a greatly reduced price. And in addition, you will immediately get all the information, almost all, there'll be a little more in the book, almost everything that's in the book, 450-page manuscript, over 800 citations. And this manuscript has already got me on to 4 TV appearances on the new media, the conservative media. We don't even try the old media. We're already selling this book and getting people asking to quote from the manuscript and more good things happening. So get the manuscript in advance so I can relax and know the information's out there, and then you'll get the book when it's available. And now back to America the Exceptional. I've had long conversations with Frank, and I learned from him, and I'm always surprised, because I'm kind of a stupid elitist, that a fireman with a college degree is this smart. Now, that's prejudice, folks. That's prejudice against white firemen, I guess.
There we go.
Frank qualifies to teach at any university in the world, and I hope some will get in touch with him and say, why don't you come and teach here? He just has an incisive mind and brain, and I hope you don't mind my teasing you about the...
No, that's all right. I think that's an important way to begin, because there's all kinds of learning, and I think that when we're looking at the plight that America has right now, there is, and especially for me personally, I had figured that I was doing my duty by my hands-on approach to helping my neighbor. And after 9/11, I realized that there's an intersection. I'm looking at the world and the need for good people to stand out, and individually in the neighborhood, to the people that you encounter, the same thing. And it became an intersection for me. And as I watched what happened after 9/11, that's what kind of inspired me to do more. And didn't know that there was going to be a book in it, but as things, as time went on, that's exactly how it played out, and God has a plan. I wanted to begin by just starting off by telling people that if you're looking at the United States of America and you think, yes, there's something wrong, we used to stand out, that we were exceptional, and that somehow we're giving up that ground, and that we're no longer distinguishing ourselves, then it would behoove you to go back to a time when it was naturally understood that we were exceptional, and to see if you could find a difference. And that was the whole purpose of my research, was to actually go back, and it began as an expose on freedom, but I couldn't limit myself to that, because the more research that I did, the more that it became inevitable that I had to go back to the minds of the founding fathers to say what it is that we have lost, because it became very obvious to me. And I'll start off by telling you a very brief story. My wife and I were visiting the city of Scranton, Pennsylvania. And as we were walking down, they have a nice downtown, and near one of the government buildings, they actually have erected these stone walls. And on them, they've inscribed quotes from different people. You'll have a sergeant that was in Iraq. You'll have a lieutenant that was in Afghanistan. You might have a quote from John Adams, right? Second president. Then goes on and on, Dwight Eisenhower. So we're going through all of them. I don't even remember how many walls there were. But I'm getting further and further on in there, numerous walls. And I see, greater love has no man than this, that one should lay down his life for one's friends. So that's an obvious quote out of the Gospel of John that's talking about Jesus speaking. And I go to the bottom and it says anonymous. So right away, I think you can see where I'm going. There is a abandoning of those, the early thought that we had. And if we were in fact exceptional at one time and we abandoned the thought, that thought process that brought us there, the outcome is going to be inevitable. So that's how I began with the book. The talk about freedom was, you know, that was a brief. You know, I was just looking at a few pages talking about how freedom allows people to express their personal exceptional talents that God gives them. But this is a whole different, this is a whole different expose. And so when you look at where we are today and you see like the riots over the summer, you see, you know, you just see some of the chaos that's going on. I'm going to read a quote from Fulton Sheen. He said, "The best definition of peace that the world has ever had is that given by St. Augustine. Quotes, peace is the tranquility of order. It is not tranquility alone. Peace adds to quietude the idea of order. Since peace is order, it follows that peace is inseparable from justice. Peace is the work of justice indirectly, insofar as justice removes obstacles to peace." And so I might tell your audience that maybe we are placing obstacles in the way of justice. And what is the natural outcome? So, you know, I think I had mentioned when we spoke last week, I like to look at people that are looking at America from the outside. So I mentioned Alexis de Tocqueville. I mentioned Alexander Solzhenitsyn, a little bit more contemporary. Solzhenitsyn came and spoke at Harvard University in 1978. Mm-hmm. And he was not well received. His comment on the American West was, or the West was, "A decline in courage may be the most striking feature which an outside observer notices in the West in our days. Political and intellectual bureaucrats show depression, passivity, and perplexity in their actions, statements, and even more so in theoretical reflections to explain how realistic, reasonable, and even morally warranted it is to base state policies on weakness and cowardice." So, if that strikes a nerve with you, it strikes a nerve with me, because I'm looking at that and I'm saying these, both of these men were spot on. That's exactly what I'm seeing in America today, and worse, because I think people have already exploited that weakness. And so that's where we can begin, I think.
It's a very, very good beginning. Frank and I are think in very similar references often, and I quote Solzhenitsyn at the very, in the, I think it's the very last chapter of the COVID-19 and the Global Predators book, because it's so appropriate. And it's because what I found looking into more and more of what was going on with Fauci and so on, that they're actually making us into cowards. They are grinding us into the ground with the wearing of masks, with the being afraid to be near each other, with the cowardly acquiescence to vaccines or anything else that the government tells us we have to do, with our sitting back and not just marching in by the millions to Washington against the idea that we're going to have passports for our with our vaccinations on them, not to go abroad, but to go almost anywhere. That something has happened in America. Frank, you come from a tradition of firemen, first responders, who I'm sure pride themselves in courage. This is a little aside, but do you think that one of the reasons why they want to defund the police force is not the obvious political reasons, but that they want to replace brave, conservative, patriotic Americans with their brand of, passive Americans, so that the police force won't be one of the groups standing up to globalism and standing up for America?
I think that's a fair observation. I think that, definitely part of it is to defang them. I think that they wanted to make them basically ineffective, which is they've definitely succeeded in that because I personally know New York City police officers that have told me that there is no way they can actually do their job without being criticized. So, and we've seen some of the things, New York City being, where I'm most familiar, the pouring of water on the heads of police officers and there's really no response and, crowds that are gathering so that their lives are actually in danger because you really don't know what's coming around the corner, right? You can assume that they just want to poke fun at you, or it could be worse. And if you're watching what's going on in Manhattan these days, I wouldn't assume anything less than the worst because I'm looking at things that would never have been seen when I was a boy growing up. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think that's a perfectly fine assessment.
You live in Brooklyn, right?
No, I grew up in the Bronx. Now I live
The
up in
Bronx.
New Jersey.
You live in New Jersey. Okay. And where were you on 9/11?
In 9/11, I was assigned to the 6th Division, which is housed in 71 Engine and 55 Truck, which is near Yankee Stadium. And so, if you want me to tell you a little bit about that morning, so on September the 11th, I came into work like it was a beautiful day. And when I arrived at the firehouse, the house watchman told me that a plane had hit the World Trade Center. And you don't know what you're looking at then. I went upstairs and realized that this was much more than, the biplane or the Cessna that hit the Empire State Building. This was a real tragedy. And I remember looking at it, but we have a gung-ho attitude. You always assume that you're going to put this out like every fire. And so I remember laughing with the aide there saying that, somehow not laughing, but boy, I'm glad I'm not working in Manhattan. These guys got their work cut out for them, not knowing what was going to happen.
Right.
And then when those buildings came down, I got on my knees with tears in my eyes because the response is an aggressive interior attack, and I knew that everybody that entered the building was gone. So I got down there the following morning. I was actually in the quarters of Engine 71, and it was a mustering site for the Bronx, and people were getting on city buses to go down to Ground Zero. And I just called out to five of the men from 71 Engine. I just said, if I get the chief, we'll just get on a bus and go. And that's exactly what happened. And I didn't get back that day until probably about 5 or 6 in the morning the following day. And it was an unnerving scene because I think up until the point where I actually got on the pile of rubble, I had anticipated making a difference. That I was going to see things, I was going to know how to operate, where to go, what to do, like every other fire. And when I got there, this was an overwhelming scene. And I remember that one of our firemen had radioed to me that he had found a void. So I went climbing through the rubble. There was no way to get through it except to basically shimmy through it like a snake. You just kind of like, you're basically on your all fours. And I never found him. He made his own way out. I actually found a subway station, and I saw 7 floor joists from the Trade Center in the station. I counted them because I couldn't believe what I was looking at. And you figure that a floor joist from a building like that, you're talking about a major size. And 7 of them in there took up the entire station, and so there was no space in between them. I realized that everything was pulverized. That's when I had that sinking feeling, that there is nobody that's coming out of this.
So this is so extraordinary. Did you actually climb through like a mole through rubble? Did you know there was something at the end of it that you were going to get to?
No, you're just looking for people.
And you pop out into the subway station.
Yeah.
Wow. That in itself is kind of mind-blowing. When you first got there, and I know this might not be something you want to talk about, but I think we can't run away from letting Americans know what this is like because the major media, publishing industry, the movies are all avoiding this. When you got to I mean, what we do remember is the president standing there and making some, reasonable remarks of some kind. But what was it like to stand at the rubble, to come upon it, to look at it? I mean, what did it mean to you about God, about life, about you, about where we were in the world? Can you, or did you just have, oh my God, and blank your memory after?
No, that's actually, that's a very good point, because that's what inspired me to start writing about what was going on in the country, because that expanded my whole view. Right? You had this devastation, and you knew that this was an attack from the outside, from foreigners. It made the whole world part of the whole response. And I started to look at how the country did respond to it, because, you know, we have, you know, I grew up and we talked about
war. But you know, Frank, I would like you to just try to tell us what it felt like to be there, unless you just don't want to. Because there's some kind of depth of experience there that you have that hardly anybody on earth has. I mean, was it awesome, terrifying? Did you cry? And I want to ask you again, if you just say, Pete, no.
No, that's all right. That's all right.
I don't want to go there, Peter Bregan.
No, that's all, that's perfectly fine. Well, first of all, I think that as a first responder, you're kind of bound by duty. So you're not going to allow those kinds of images and thoughts and things to enter what you're doing. I think that a lot of that stuff, and I think that even military people will tell you the same thing, that it's not until later on when you start to you think about these things. But when I went there, it was not what I expected. It was almost surreal. I thought that, you know, a movie set would be the only place where you could present something like this. They're basically, because of the extent of the rubble, the clouds of smoke, nothing was clear. I remember looking through the clouds at fires going on all over the rubble and all over buildings that were partially standing, and it wasn't clear. It was just like orange, just like an orange glow rather than a flame. You're not looking at anything that's, it kind of reminded me like of one of the original Batman movies. I was like, this is, it's dark. I'm there in the daytime. It's just not, you know, it's just not not real. It was devastating. And the piles of rubble were 7, 8, 9 floors high. As I was walking to ground to the pile that we called it, where the buildings actually, you know, I guess the promenade there, it took me quite a few blocks to actually get to it. And as I looked down each street as I was passing it, you had 8 or 9 floors of rubble, making those streets impossible. Everything just poured out onto that street. And so you start to think as you're walking about all of the people that you know responded. I had friends of mine that I know responded. And, you know, you're just saying, where are they? You know, it became like a mystery, because we found nobody. You didn't find remains of anything. It was just the most unnerving. You know, there's, you know, we used to make a joke, you know, there's never been a fire that we didn't put out, you know, and I'm looking at this and months that thing was burning. We're just looking and thinking about everybody that we lost. And I don't know if that answers your question, but
well, it's,
I think
it's,
some of the horror.
Yeah.
Yeah. That came up later.
But thank you about that. And I won't ask you anything about the stuff that comes up later. I'm not here to do that kind of work. And you look great. You just sound so strong. So you told me one thing about that the sky was coming down with all this white material. And that tell folks about that. That I just realized today that you were talking about the second day and the sky was still full.
Yeah. Well, when the sky, it was a beautiful day. The second day was beautiful also. And the command post, the big command post was on West Street. And so that's where we all went first to receive our orders. So they were basically rotating people in. So they would relieve people and rotate new people in. And so we stood there for probably, I don't know, over an hour, maybe 2 hours, while just waiting to be called in. And could see the sun, you know, weren't that close to actually ground zero in the pile. But I remember looking and I'm saying, wow, you know, it's the breathing here isn't that good. And I'm watching all of this white flakes coming down. And I was like, what is that? So I bent down to pick up one of them. And it was essentially the corner, the very small corners of white copier paper, which apparently that was the only thing that wasn't completely incinerated or crushed, or it never picked up a piece of a phone or a computer or, a, you know, nothing like that, a desk or a table or chair. Didn't find anything like that in the rubble. Then I'm, maybe somebody else did, I don't know, but I didn't see it. Just a lot of concrete and a lot of glass and a lot, just an amazing devastation. You couldn't believe it was the World Trade Center.
Well, that is really amazing. Well, pick up wherever you would like. I'm kind of just caught up in your images and wordless, which is quite unusual.
It's all right. I think about me for over 20 years being wordless. So finally, I got a book out. But you know, I got very worried about the country, and I'm still very worried about the country. My book is not going to make a difference. People have to wake up. It's out there to remind them because we have.
Let me say again, this is America, the Exceptional. It's a great title.
Thank you, Peter.
It's right in the face of our President Obama and that whole group of people who went around the world telling the world we're not exceptional.
Apologize.
And what a terrible thing to say for our children. In fact, we are exceptional. That's what Frank's book is about. We are exceptional, folks.
And I, you know, I ask people to kind of distinguish between the sins of a human being and the sins of a nation. What America is and what individuals in America do are two different things. And America has a credo that's announced in the Declaration of Independence that brought the melting pot into existence. That's why we're much different than other countries. And so people always, up until this generation, identified by the Declaration of Independence. This is what they wanted. And so it really didn't have anything to do. I think I mentioned last week, I was telling you that it's important to define what American exceptionalism is, right? Because you're in one generation, I'm in the next. People in their 40s, you know, the middle-aged people, they're in another generation. You get people that are in college. We all look at America with the same vision. We see power, we see wealth. We know that these are exceptional things, but that's not what American exceptionalism is, because if it were, then we wouldn't be able to look at the founders as exceptional, because we didn't have a nation that was wealthy like that, powerful like that. So it has to be something else. And so that was the quest, to show people what it was that these people brought into this new country. And so that's I think an important question. If people just sit back for a second and just ponder that, they're going to realize that we have to go a little bit deeper. And what I'm trying to show them is that it's a spiritual context, that there's something in here is what makes America exceptional. And when you think about, I don't think I brought this up last week, but there's the if you're familiar with the Great Seal of the United States, mm-hmm. I found some interesting things. It was going to be an aside, like in the end of the book somewhere, but I couldn't get by the fact that the Great Seal of the United States was actually an order of Congress on July the 4th, 1776. So a lot of stuff happening on July the 4th, 1776. We're not a nation. We're at war. We're trying to become an independent nation. And that's an important distinction, right? Because otherwise, now, if you're trying to create a great seal for your nation, right, and you're not a nation, you're kind of putting the cart before the horse. A lot of these men would have been hung at the gallows if they had lost the war. So to be thinking on July the 4th, rather than, you know, requisitioning more soldiers and, you know, armor and, you know, things like that to win the war, and instead worrying about a great seal, it was very strange to me. So I went and looked into it a little bit more. And so what I found was they put on this committee Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams, who each made a proposal. And when Congress received their proposal, they rejected all three of them. So now they're taking it a little bit too serious for me. It's one thing to say, all right, I want to put a seal up there. And it's another one to reject those three thinkers. And it's interesting now, they came up with a second committee and a third committee and rejected them all. It took them 6 years to come up with a Great Seal. And so why was that so important? And so I proposed to people reading the book that it was because they were acknowledging the help of divine power. Take a look at how long over the 200 plus years that we've been in existence, how long we referred to ourselves as a Christian nation. So in my book, I actually recorded, because that was something that I asked myself. And as I looked, I actually saw Supreme Court arguments that actually in the justices' opinions, they actually put that obviously we are a Christian nation, and that was part of their answer. And so, and I can find all the way up until I think 1898 was a specific justice. I forget his name. I think it was Breyer. But no, over and over again, references to the United States as a Christian nation, strangely, up until probably about 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and then all of a sudden just stops. And I think they've created a conflict between freedom of religion and the idea that we're a Christian nation. And part of my argument is that the reason that we have freedom of religion is because we're a Christian nation. I think that it particularly argues in Christianity to allow people to introduce another way that's not coercive. So Christianity is not intended to be coerced upon people. So I don't know if that makes sense, but
Well, I think it makes a lot of sense that these men assumed a deep belief in providence, as Washington referred to God. By the way, I have three pictures of George Washington in my room. I would put them on the camera, but I'm afraid I would lose my connectivity or something. One is of George Washington over my desk, which is a new picture. It's a print, a color print, and just shows him praying. One is a very famous copy of a very famous drawing, painting of him kneeling in the snow and praying with his horse nearby, which was much ridiculed by all the progressive historians until very recent times, when people started actually reading what Washington said and not skipping his references to Providence as dressing. And they even eventually have a witness from the Winters at Valley Forge that he would go off by himself and pray. And then I have an original Currier and Ives that's actually from my mother-in-law Jean, of him sitting back, Washington, imagining liberty, which happened to be women, interestingly enough. And
There
that's
is
a
a you're familiar with Stars and Stripes magazine, the magazine of the military?
Yeah, I know. It's not a
It used to
regular
be called, I
reading for
think.
me.
Yeah, no, I have, I don't have a copy of it, but it used to be called the National Tribune. And there is a copy, I forget the year, I have it in there, of a reprint of an article from like the 1850s. There was a lone survivor of Valley Forge who was being interviewed on the 4th of July for this National Tribune magazine. He was 99 years old, and he had served under George Washington at Valley Forge. And he was recounting an event that he found extremely peculiar of Washington, who was apparently, in his esteem, unflappable. In fact, in all of the battles they had been, in every circumstance, including Valley Forge, his stoic nature never changed, except for this one moment. And he came out of his quarters and was pale as a ghost, and they all asked him, like, "What's the matter?" And he came out, and he said that he had a vision. And so the vision was of a woman who was giving him detailed account of the future of the United States, including the revolution, which she showed him that they would win. It really came down to, I think, one in particular that particularly unnerved him was far out in the future. And one looks like it could have been the Civil War or something along that he was alluding to, because they were talking about how angels would pick up cups of water and pour it in his vision over the continent, and the Americans would rally and win. And the last one was an image of armies from Europe, Asia, and Africa, all descending on the United States of America, and that we were fleeing as our cities were being burned to the center of the country, and that it wasn't until an angel actually again dipped its hand into the ocean and poured the water over the continent that the Americans rallied and drove these armies back to where they came from.
Wow. No, I know nothing of that, Frank. Folks, that's what we need. The reason Frank and I, well, speak for myself, the reason that I want to talk about all this is that I do not believe that we can stand up to progressivism and communism and the global predators, which is what we're facing now. In the book, I discovered something that other people had known long before me, but which I found so impossible to face. All of the people who have been global predators, the top billionaires, the top companies in the world, and the companies that have attacked Trump for wanting to close the border so we can raise our standard of living here and raise the wages of Americans. And the people are attacking that because they want to cheapen American labor like everybody else is, and who were against Trump because he was standing up to China. I followed all of these global billionaires that I could find, the top 15, 20, and the companies, and they all eventually went to communist China. They all were closely tied to China, having meetings with the Chinese. Wait till you read about some of these great heroes of the progressive movement, like Klaus Schwab, who really developed this great reset, which Kerry and the president now, Joe Biden, say is their motto, and realize that when Trump was having meetings trying to confront China and getting ready to confront China, Klaus Schwab was holding conferences with the premier of China, the president of China, Xi Jinping. And they have an ideology. The communists are not like the billionaires. They're going to just eat the billionaires. What they're out to do is to weaken America. What the billionaires want to do is weaken America. Because Klaus Schwab, I found this in his book on page 11, says that the globalism is incompatible with a patriotic democracy. So the existence of the United States of America stands before the globalists as their one threat. And now this is so fascinating that Frank, this remarkable man, is telling me this stuff I didn't know about these visions of this global assault on America, which we might say is taking place now. And I don't believe, and this is amazing for me to say as a man who was an agnostic through his 30s, that unless we develop a real love of God and a real desire to believe what we learned from the Jews and the Christians, I'm Jewish, from the Judeo-Christian tradition, that human beings are to be treasured. They are not commodities. They are to be treasured and to have freedom and to stand up for themselves. Unless we rally around the combination of the belief in God, whether you're a Muslim or a Jew or a Christian, we need to rally around that vision to defeat globalism with the belief in God and freedom, because otherwise the communist ideology with their religion, the formal religion of communist China, I kid you not, is atheism. It's formal. That's what the kids are taught. That's,
you know, Lord Acton said, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And the threat of socialism and communism is one of power, because as they appeal to the common man, who looks at, the oligarchs and says, I want a piece of that, I deserve that, they look at that and they salivate, because that's exactly what they want. Because to actually distribute wealth, you have to have control of wealth. And so the whole model of socialism is to actually centralize control of everyone's wealth and then redistribute it. And so when you give that kind of power to anyone, it has to go to someone. And usually it's the strongest person in the room, right? So that's the direction that we're going. And after reading the manuscript that you wrote, I think that that's it's spot on. And I think it asks another question, which is what we were, why we began where we did, is that how do you recognize the difference between good and evil? What is the difference between truth and a lie? And what gives you surety that you actually know it? You know, the we're talking about the Jewish and Christian traditions are linked at the hip. And so in the beginning, God created man in his own image and likeness. And that is, when you think of the word creator that we used in the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal. Who is this creator? Who are they? Right away, you have to look at the founders and say, who are they referring to? And I think that once you do that, you sit down, because it's, is it about religion or is it about God? Is it about Judaism or is it about God? Is it about Christianity or is it about Christ? We believe in a personal God that it changes it. Otherwise, you end up with an ideology, right? And your ideology can compete with my ideology and the next guy's. And who's to say who's right, right? In a free country, we're all right. I think that real freedom kind of depends. I had written a chapter. It said, free from man, slave to God, free from man, free from God, slave to man. And the way I went with it, I mean, the whole concept of sin is that if you want to free yourself from some outside authority, outside of human beings, a truth that's not changeable, then you become almost a slave to your own passions or another person's passions. So that's, it's a humbling thought.
Two thoughts about that, Frank. One on God, Zev Zelenko, who was the founder of the whole concept that you can treat COVID-19 very, very successfully. He's an Orthodox Jew who lived north of New York City. He was in some of the worst of it and was just helping a lot of people. And then was turned on even by his own community because the mayor was going after him in a very anti-Semitic fashion. And he now doesn't practice there. He's moved. And he's done a couple of shows with me on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour on YouTube and PRN-FM. And one of the things he said is when you give your trust to God, when you're grateful to God, you fear no human. And I think that is really a profoundly succinct way of putting what we're talking about. The other thing I wanted to bring up is you're very aptly characterizing that the communists use force to, and the progressives too are using it right now in this country, to redistribute the wealth, not just to have a safety net, which everybody now agrees upon, but to redistribute the wealth, which actually destroys the source of wealth, which is the, a lot of the creativity comes from wealth. So I did a study for the book of where is the wealth gone during COVID-19. And all of the top companies got immensely richer. Mm-hmm. All of the top billionaires got immensely richer. In the United States, the top 15 billionaires averaged a 50% increase in wealth. That's pretty huge, but for the 650 billionaires, it was much more modest, 16%, which is really modest in the light of the jump in the stock market. So, the top people, you know, those are the Bill Gates and so on at the top, you know, Bezos and so on, the people at Apple and all the technical people who are really most at the top. But then you go to China, which now is catching up to us. They have 450 billionaires. Guess how much all the Chinese billionaires went up in wealth during COVID-19?
I think that was in your book. Yes. Yeah. That was 60% or something.
That's
right?
God bless you. Yes, 60%. That's all the 450. So when the Chinese redistribute wealth No more than any other country do they redistribute wealth to the poor. They redistribute it to their own elite, to themselves. Yes. And in fact, capitalism, not predatory capitalism, but capitalism that has some regulation over it, is the source of the greatest increase in wealth in every class of people in the United States and throughout the world when it's implemented.
Isn't it kind of funny, you know, the controls that have always been on free market capitalism have actually not been utilized in recent times. You talk about all those billionaires, right, and think about all of the monopoly laws and what we've allowed to transpire, which is basically we saw as the president was deplatformed. And then you watch systematically as everybody that was opposing this ideology was deplatformed. And so now you realize, hey, you know what, we lost that game a long time ago. And if you're talking about just faith, I was watching two news stories this morning. In England, there was a Good Friday service. I don't know if you caught this, but the Good Friday service, a police officer went up to the altar, went to the podium, took the microphone from the priest, and ordered everybody to leave, that they were not in compliance, and that if they didn't leave, they would be fined £200 and arrested. Mm. All right. Then you had, similarly in Canada, you had a priest who was conducting a service, and the police entered, and he started shouting out, "Gestapo, get out now." And they were forced to leave. He said, "You come back with a warrant or you don't come back." And my point is that, unfortunately, I think we have many more that are like the English crowd throughout America and around the world that are not going to address this injustice. And that we are probably, the Polish priest is probably going to be right if we don't change our perspective and be willing to sacrifice a little bit now so that we don't have to sacrifice a lot later.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. I do, you know, it's hard for me to know how the audience that I once had relates to the audience I now have, how much of it's the same. You know, we've gone up to, you know, much, much higher listeners since I started getting into the politics of everything. And I want to tell folks I'm grateful for that. But I'm not trying to sell God to you. I mean, that's not my job. Although actually, do you know what the chosen people means? You know, it doesn't mean Jews are particularly handsome, smart, or anything. It means that we got burdened with spreading the word of one God. I believe, Frank, is that correct? You probably know more about that than I do.
I doubt it. I think that's pretty much it.
I think that's pretty much it. Yeah. So I don't want to be in a position of losing our folks around the issue of, is there a God or not? If you can come to a deep-seated commitment and faith in liberty and in true equality of human beings, not in the equality of what people are owed by the government, but equality in terms of being able to have the same opportunities of others, and if you believe in charity for people who are having difficulties, charity from government maybe is needed, clearly, in these huge societies, but not a government that makes everything turn out right, because it can't. The government can't make everything. So if you can't go with us to believing in God, I mean, I was an agnostic, you know, in the 1950s in high school and throughout much of my 30s, until I looked at my life and said, I've been being prepared for something. What's going on here? Why do I have these abilities? Why are those there? What's going on?
I think that, you know, when we go back to the founders, the reason the founders are important is because they were on the same page as far as that topic. And I think, you know, I had an argument with a guest coming to the West Point Military Academy that I happened to be in the car with. And, you know, we're arguing points back and forth. He was much more progressive, more leaning toward a socialist solution. And, you know, I told him, I said, you know, the real problem is that we're dealing in America with a crisis of truth. And he goes, finally, we agree on something.
Oh, you're goes, back to that. Know, Frank, you pick that up. I took you away from the what is the truth? I never let you finish. What is the truth? So pick up on that.
Yeah, so it was an interesting story because he goes, oh, that finally we agree on this. And he goes, you know, I'm a black man. You're a white man. You grew up in the city. I on the East Coast. I grew up in the West Coast. You came from a large family. I was an only child. He goes, so we naturally, truth is going to mean different things to the two of us because of our experiences. And I said, so he goes, and he's nodding. And I said, yeah, no, you don't get it at all. And he says, what? I said, no, you don't get it at all. The truth, I mean, you're an educator, right? I'm trying to be an educator. The truth doesn't depend on what Frank thinks. The truth doesn't depend on what you think, Chris. The truth is the truth. And so as an educator, we got to go find it. Can't deliver a false truth. It's not something that is here today and changes tomorrow. So I think that's...
Frank, my feelings are hurt. What about my truth?
Isn't that where we are?
Right. What about my truth?
Right. And so if I'm the one that's going to define the truth, look where that's going to lead me, right? Because tomorrow it might be a different truth. It's interesting, right? We just finished Easter. And on Good Friday, we read the scripture there where Pontius Pilate says to Jesus, when he's questioning, Jesus says, I came to testify to the truth. He who hears the truth hears my voice. Pilate looks at him and he says, what is truth? And here we are, we've gone full circle, and we're asking the same question. We don't really have a truth.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's really where our plight is. We are a different country because we had a truth, and now we have 350 million truths, right? Because everybody's truth is important. And I think that we have to come to that conclusion that to make it all work, we have to be on the same page. And how do you get there?
My experience, Frank, of coming to accept God's presence in my life ended up having nothing to do with my intellect at all. It was from going through such enormous attacks when I was younger, in my 30s, first started taking on the pharmaceutical industry and the electroshock machine industry, such as it was, and so on, that I could no longer explain why I was able to do something that somebody else hadn't done. I couldn't figure that out. I couldn't figure out why I'd been saved at the nick of time from everything, from attacks on my life to attacks on my medical license. I couldn't even figure out, ultimately, why did I do what I was doing anyway? And it came to me, I'm supposed to. And so I started what are you supposed to? By whom? Your father certainly didn't give you a model for that. Your mother certainly didn't. Your teachers didn't, by and large. In fact, they were upset at your intensity, met some of them. Others deeply admired it. It began to dawn on me that there was someone that I couldn't describe. It wasn't a man sitting on a cloud. It wasn't even necessarily a man. It's like the Catholic catechisms. They say you can't conceive of what God is in terms of gender or humanity exactly. But I just became convinced. And as I started to thank God for my abilities, for my health, for the being there, protecting me when I was fighting, And then I started reading George Washington. And way ahead of me, he was talking about these things, just talking about exactly these things. I began to think, you come to God, many of us, not through our intellects, as smart ass as I thought I was, you come to God through your experience. And then you can begin to bring it. So if you have, in fact, I remember thinking God was too good an idea and too selfish an idea when I was a kid. I would pray to God, say, yeah, very little boy, help me win this race. I want to be an Olympic athlete. And then I say, well, that's not fair. So I think about it. And I think, well, that's not fair. So I can't ask God. And then I'd let go of God because I didn't have a deeper idea about what he might be about. But So what about for you, Frank? Has it been more personal, more intellectual, that that you have put this at the center of perhaps your courage and your life?
I can't say that I was an agnostic, but I think that I went through a period like that myself. I think that being a fireman, I joined the fire department at 27, and I think that I think you have a very naive view of life. As you go into these tragedies, you realize that suffering is something that's real. It's not a front page headline. It's actually, you're looking at people's agony. And I think that that's when you start to look a little deeper mm-hmm. into what life's about and what you can do. I remember John F. Kennedy, because this is actually, it's an interesting thing, right? Because we don't want to get too deep into religious beliefs as much as what it is to make a right. difference. And John F. Kennedy said that you can't have a discussion, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, you can't have a discussion on rights without also talking about your personal responsibilities. And so I think that that's the key, right? Because as individuals, we make a difference when we work together to solve problems, right? If two people see a rock and they each get on the opposite side of it and they push, the rock goes nowhere. But if they get on the same side, they move it. And so that's what we need to do. And we're doing the opposite. We've created a division today. And George Washington in his farewell address, it was almost like he was reading into the future. He started talking about the Constitution and identifying those forces that would actually fight the laws that are in the Constitution for the running of the government. And he said that factions will be created. And those factions in the form of parties will actually move to destroy the Constitution itself and the potent engines that actually initiated the conflict in the first place. So you think about our party system and what it's devolved into. And you see that these men actually saw that that threat was there right from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so they were suspicious of it at all times. And I think that we've lost that. I think that we have a reliance on certain things that we expect to be out for our best interest. And just like you were talking in your book, they're not out for our best interest. There's a whole different game going on.
Yes.
And I think that that's when knowledge of good and evil and reflecting on it is very important, rather than being naive and assuming that everything stays the same. And right now, we really need to pull together people that actually care about their neighbor, rather than looking at, this hyphenated American is one of the things that has to cease.
Yes.
Because if I truly, it doesn't matter what I look like, then we have to start identifying, stop identifying by what we look like and start identifying as a patriotic American, as an American first. And then that other thing won't matter.
Absolutely. Frank, we've sped through our time. Frank's book, America the Exceptional, you can get it at Amazon. Go get it. And at the same time, you will find that they really run in beautifully together. This book was written before COVID-19. And then go and get my COVID-19 book, Peter and Ginger Breggin. I sometimes call it my book, folks, because I wrote every word of it. Ginger inspires, corrects, instructs, and researches. It is, as several of our books that we've done together, a co-authored book. And
that book is fantastic. And if that doesn't cause an awakening, I don't know what it's going to take to awaken people.
Thank you, Frank.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You. Whoa, I just banged my camera.
I still
so,
see it.
What I want to say again is where to get it real quick. You can get it by going to the subtitle of the book, which is wearethepray.com. Wearethepray.com. And the minute you sign up for the book, the instant you sign up for the book, you won't get the book for a month, maybe, whatever, because it's going through copy editing. You'll immediately get the manuscript. You'll even see how bad a copy editor I am. You'll get the manuscript with 400 plus pages. the completed book, basically, there'll be some additions. I always put stuff in at the end. But basically, you're going to get the manuscript, 440 pages, over 800 references. It's free as a bonus with the already very reduced price book. That's because I want to get the data out to you. So, go to Amazon, get Frank Moore, Lieutenant Frank Moore. It says right on the front, America the Exceptional. Later, you can get my book on Amazon. For now, go to wearethepray.com. Frank Moore, I don't know what to say. I love talking to you. I learn from you. You're quickly becoming a friend. And thanks for being in this world, sir. Thanks for writing this good book.